Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Which one are we doing? 327, Make Me Care? Make me care, make me care. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. Aww.
Oh, that? So that's, I'm supposed to stop rambling and start? Fine, here we go. Oh, look, and I'm cute, too. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Oh! Welcome to Make Me Smart,
we got
the podcast
laugh,
about economics,
everybody.
Tech, and culture. We are trained professionals, everyone. And thank God we have you,
I know,
because
right?
None of us is as smart, focused, or on top of the news as you. No, all of us.
No, together. All of us.
Together
all of us. Hello. This week
together.
We are going to hear from Yochai Benkler, co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He will help us untangle some connections between Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and answer one question, which is reasonably simple, but not so much. Why, oh, why should we care about this?
Yes, because there are those of you who do, and there are those of you who do not.
Well,
and
yeah,
that is going to be the purpose of this interview today. We will also get some insight. This is one of those wonderful moments where one of you makes everybody smart.
Oh, yeah.
About Facebook quizzes and what data they deliver from a listener who helped write some of those quizzes. You're going to love this.
Seriously, you will. All right, but first. So, we could call it a news fix, or we could call it the Facebook Cambridge Analytica, holy cow, it's still going on fix. How about that? Right?
I think we should call it the data is the problem fix. I think it's like a good time to start to make the pivot into, hey, you guys, this is what the data economy hath wrought.
Huh.
And also Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, but mainly Facebook. The FTC did, just as a little update on that, in case you have not followed it obsessively, I went out of town for a couple days. The FTC issued a public statement saying, yes, they are going to take action
yep.
against companies that fail to honor their privacy promises. This is in the FTC's charter. They have opened an investigation into Facebook's privacy practices based on a consent decree.
Mm-hmm.
with Facebook from back in 2011,
mm-hmm.
you know, at which time Facebook, huh, that's so weird. I think that was like the fifth time that Facebook said, oh my God, we're so sorry that happened. We could have handled that better. We did not do a great job communicating with our users. Here are the changes to your privacy policy that we're going to make, and we're going to let you have a lot more control. See, we're doing it.
Or maybe not so
much. And they've
so
done
much.
It six more times since
yeah.
then.
The yeah, interesting exactly. part of that consent degree, I think, is the $40,000 per offense, right?
Yes.
You know, that's the potential fine and punishment.
If it ends up being 50 million profiles
right.
at $40,000 per,
right.
that is one of the few
right.
things, as we said last week, I think that could get
yep.
Mark Zuckerberg to stand up and take attention, pay attention. He has, I will say, the apology tour goes on with up to and including a full page ad.
Yeah, but that was so bogus. Come on. Don't you think?
No, the whole thing is bogus.
Yeah.
Yes. No one should be buying
right.
this. This is all that
right.
Facebook does.
All right. So this goes to the whole Facebook still doesn't get it question, which I ask you every single freaking bleeping time we talk about this. Just today, it's Tuesday. What's today? The 27th, right? Just this morning, he was invited to testify over in the UK to a House of Commons committee, and he respectfully declined and said, no, but I will personally ask my chief product guy to go over there and talk to you. I don't think he understands that, and maybe I'm putting too much faith in the Congress of the United States, and that's entirely possible, but there will come a point in the not-too-distant future where he will be standing in front of that long green witness table, voluntarily or involuntarily, perhaps, and I think he doesn't understand that that day is coming.
It is sort of like, this is an Ouroboros situation,
a
right?
What?
The snake that eats its own head.
Wow.
Ouroboros.
Go show off.
It would be like a really neat tattoo if you were into that kind of thing. The snake that eats its own head. But he won't care until we care, which sort of gets to, right? Like,
yep.
It is not. Look, I got a research note rating Facebook a buy last week on Wednesday.
Really?
Wednesday. It was ranking Facebook and outperform, and the market analysis was that none of this will substantially hurt Facebook's business.
And here's a question and corollary. Have you, and I don't know how much you're on Facebook, and let me say actually now, I have deleted Facebook off my phone. I've deleted Facebook off my iPad, right? I use it only on a laptop and intermittently at best. Have you noticed in your browsing of Facebook a decrease in postings from friends and family?
Well, so I have done what you have done, but a few, I've been doing that for a while. I took Facebook off my phone, I don't know, a few months ago. And so now I visit Facebook maybe every other week, maybe once a week, if I remember. I want to check in on this one, you know, family member who's having a baby. And I value that. I do still value that. But part of the reason I think that I found it easy to step away from Facebook is that it is not as interesting as it used to be. Like, it really is all about the content. And we've talked about this, too, and how they're sort of marched toward, oh, we're going to prioritize the things from friends and family. All of that is about the fact that it had gotten boring for people. So at the end of the day, you know, we've talked a lot about whether Facebook is or is not optional on marketplace tech and everywhere else. And there are reasons that Facebook does underpin a lot of what we do. And there are reasons to demand that it be safer because it does allow people to congregate when they don't have anywhere else to get together, or if they have, you know, someone gave the example of like a really rare illness.
Right.
You can
find
a group for that on Facebook, right? Or you can organize, or you can be a dissenter, or you can be a school, a public school who doesn't have the resources to build a website. And so you're on Facebook.
Or a small business, right? Or a small business whose relationships with its customers is through its Facebook page. I mean, we had one of those on Marketplace the other day. That's totally right. So for some people, you know, getting out is not an option. Here's the other problem, though, right? Is that there's no Lyft to Facebook's Uber.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
And I think, and people still don't care. I mean, they really don't care.
Yep.
And that is, and fundamentally, the not caring is what enables what somebody on Twitter just brilliantly called surveillance capitalism.
Yeah.
Like, that is what the web is right now. It is surveillance capitalism. And we just became frogs in a boiling pot over time. You know, we gave up a little data to get something back, and we gave up a little more to get something back. And then we, and it went so much farther than we thought. But until people say this bargain is not worth it, I don't know that Mark Zuckerberg, who has been 100% aware of this bargain since he started the social network in his dorm room, right? He knows exactly what he is doing.
Yeah. Just now on CNN, actually, I should say, just because we were talking about him and testifying, Facebook sources tell CNN the 33-year-old CEO has come to terms with the fact that he will have to testify before Congress within a matter of weeks, and Facebook is currently planning the strategy for his testimony. That's going to be some prime viewing right there, because it's going to
be good TV.
It's going to be a
mess. He is not good TV.
He is not, and it's terrible. And I don't, And you know what the problem is, right? I mean, they know that he's not good in those situations, I think.
You know what it is? It's because there's no deniability.
Yeah.
And look, let me be clear. If you got Google CEOs up there, if you got Larry Page or Sundar Pichai up there, or Eric Schmidt up there, you know, if you got Jeff Bezos up there and you asked them about data collection and privacy and whether, in fact, that was the fundamental model underlying their entire business, in particular Google, they also have no deniability.
Yeah, but
like, we're, you know, we're talking a lot about Facebook now, but the data is the problem. And that gets directly, in fact, that story about how Facebook apparently was scraping call and text messaging data on Android phones.
Yeah.
That's an Android story.
Yep. And Android is Google. Let's make sure everybody remembers that. Yeah.
And Android is Google. Right. Exactly. And Android leaks data like crazy between apps, and the iPhone doesn't. It's annoying. Yeah. It's the reason that like Twitter doesn't know I'm logged into New York Times, but it also protects you. And Google, I have friends who won't use Android phones because they say Android at this point is essentially spyware.
Right.
For Google.
And you know, people piss and moan about Apple a lot, but say this for them, they've been fairly resolute in their stand on privacy and data belongs to consumers and not the company.
Yeah, it's really interesting too, because I think that there were probably some analysts who were starting to say, "Boy, you know, Apple might really be missing the boat by not getting on because they've never been in the data game."
Yeah.
Except internal, you know, except for making their own apps better with your data and predictive stuff. But yeah, they don't share. They don't let apps share data. they've always had this firewall, and I'm sure that there are some analysts who wish that they would make even more ungodly amounts of money by getting into the data game, but they may end up looking like the smart ones for making privacy a it is a great talking point for them, but it has also been built into their technology.
Yeah. So let's give the shout out here, right? Let's give the plug and say, listen, tell us what you think about this whole Facebook mess, because y'all out there, I mean, yes, clearly you're smart and erudite people because you listen to this podcast, but probably most of you are on Facebook. So let us know what you think about privacy and getting scraped and all of that stuff, because this one's not going away. I truly do actually think that this time is different.
I think so. I think a lot of things are different. I agree. Because the frog just woke up all at once everywhere.
Wait, was the frog sleeping in the pot? The frog wasn't sleeping in that pot of boiling water.
The frog just didn't realize. The frog was like, wait, what? Okay, snapped out of it.
All right, okay.
The frog just looked around in horror, shrieked, noticed its skin sloughing off into the pot.
Oh my
God. We could go pretty far.
Have you had frog's legs? They're tasty. Anyway, it's a whole different podcast.
That's what Mark Zuckerberg says. Anyway, when you bring up this discussion, though, and when you ask whether things are going to change, there are people in our own office. There are people everywhere who say, why should I care about this?
Well, there are people sitting in front of the microphone who say, why should I care?
There are people sitting in front of the microphone. So I care. I'm not totally sure that Kai cares or gets it.
Well, hold on. Let's hold on.
I just left him. I mean, that was mean. You get it. But
I need somebody to tell me why I have to care about this.
Yeah. And so we figured so do many other people. So I left Kai to get smart with Yochai Benkler at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for the Internet and Society on why this is a big deal for all of us. And this is the first, I haven't heard this either. So I'm waiting to see if Kai has been convinced.
Let me ask a subjective question first, if I might, and get your take on why this episode makes all the data stories we've heard for the past, I don't know how many years, feel somehow different.
Well, I think what's different about this story is the sheer scale of the data that Cambridge Analytica captured and the degree to which the capture was basically illegal. And those two are very powerful. Particularly when they're combined with a company that whose whole business model is to say that they manipulate people's political opinions in the context of critical elections.
Right. So let me just make sure here. Right. It was shady, but was it illegal? I'm not aware that any laws were actually broken.
So it depends on whether you're in the U.S. or the U.K.
Okay.
What's fairly clear is that in the U.S., that's essentially a violation of the terms of the user sharing agreement with Facebook. But it looks like in the U.K., that's actually a violation of the privacy laws.
Do you suppose that the fact that the end use of this manipulation and scraping up of the data was political changes the perception at all?
I think the fact that the use was political, particularly that Cambridge Analytica used it in campaigns like the Brexit campaign, like the 2016 election, that seems so foundational to the direction of a country, makes it much more about democracy and about our ability to govern ourselves as a society than most of the conversations up till now, which were about us as consumers. This goes very much to the heart of, can we be citizens? And that's different.
So my next question was going to be, help me understand why I should care. But when you frame it that way, it makes a difference. But there's a slice of this conversation that has to do with just companies manipulating our data. Let's take the politics out of it for a second and help me understand why companies being able to use and manipulate our data matters to the person in Sheboygan or South Florida or Seattle, Washington.
There are several trends combining in this. The first one is we have a whole line of behavioral marketing that has been developing for years, whose purpose it is to use the most cutting-edge behavioral psychology to manipulate us into wanting things and believing things. whether or not we would have thought we want them. That gets combined with very large-scale experiments. Essentially, the platform companies, Facebook, Google, are running continuous experiments on millions of us. If you move something a little bit this way or a mm-hmm. little bit that way, how would it affect? So you have cutting-edge behavioral science connected with mass-scale experiments on large populations, all of which are intended to see, what can I do to make you click? What can I do to make you want this or want to pay a little bit more for that or pay a little bit more for the other? What happens essentially, the whole idea, both of a free market and of a free democracy, is built on the idea that we come to the market or we come to voting with some set of preferences, with some set of beliefs. And then we pay more, we pay less because of what we want, or we vote for this person or that person because of what we want. Here suddenly we have an entire behavioral science and an entire marketing system that's intended to select for us what we want before we get to decide what we buy or what we vote for.
Okay, but wait. I hear that, but here's my question. There has been manipulative marketing in consumer goods forever. There's been manipulative marketing in politics forever. Is the objection, do you think, that people don't know they're being manipulated?
The objection is twofold. First, the amount and quality of data about each individual allows for much finer grained and, we believe, much more precise manipulation at the individual level. The second, because each one of us can be shown a different ad or a slightly different model, advertisers don't have to make any trade-offs. I can target you very specifically with a political ad that will make you very angry and hateful towards the other side or make you want to stay home. And I don't have to take responsibility for having said that because no one else will see that ad. Whereas if you're in a broadcast model or a print mm-hmm. model, you have to make some kind of an average assessment of how many people will you lose and how many people will you gain.
Let me give you the straight up capitalist comeback, though, right? If I'm running Facebook and my objective here is to maximize profits for my shareholders, and this data usage lets me advertise more or my clients or whoever uses the data, advertise to clients more effectively, run my business more efficiently, maximize my profits, isn't that a greater good?
It's not a greater good so much as it's better for you as a company. But we make policy not based on what's good for one company, but what is based on maximizing welfare. The way we know that a particular decision maximizes welfare is when everyone shows up and says, I'm willing to pay this much for this, and you're willing to pay that much for that. And overall, we say the goods are going to go to the people who value them the most. But when the preferences that we come into the market are themselves being manipulated, we have no idea whether the fact that I bought this rather than that or paid $2 rather than $3 is efficient. There's no way of assessing whether the market is actually working or not, when the very preferences that we come into the market with are themselves the subject of manipulation. You can't make a capitalist argument for this. You can only make a rent-seeking argument about the benefits to the individual firm, not the benefits of the market to society at large.
Final question, sir, and then I'll let you go. You know, we've talked a lot in the last 11 or whatever it is minutes about the responsibility of the companies and perhaps even government regulators. Where does the responsibility for the consumer fall? To what degree must regular people take some responsibility for their data?
I think one of the things that came out very clearly of this particular case is that there was nothing that the overwhelming majority of people who were subject to this data collection could have done. Of the 50 million people whose data was collected, only 270,000 actually did anything affirmative. The rest simply were subject to collection. Mm-hmm. And part of what happens when you're a user in a system that you can't escape because you have to use it, Otherwise, you're socially isolated or you're commercially unable to reach people. When you are subject to terms of service over which you have no power to negotiate, you can decide to take your marbles and not use this, but for most people, that's not an option. Other than that, there's very little you can do against this kind of platform-side manipulation because you have no control over it.
So that was a whole lot of Yochai Benkler right there. But interesting stuff, I think. What'd you think? That's the first time you've heard it. Also, by the way, the first time I've really heard it, because we were on a Skype line, and I honestly only got about 6 words out of every 10 he was saying. But so it was interesting for me to hear as well.
Yeah, he's so good, right? Because he's so measured. Yeah. I mean, what I found particularly fascinating, I thought that was such a great explanation of sort of what you can't do. And there are two things that really interest me about this. One is people's resistance to the idea that they can be swayed by the messages they see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, since this broke, I have had people look at me with a straight face and say, I'm just on Facebook to see what my friends are doing. I'm not getting any messaging.
Right.
I'm not swayed by any of the stuff that I see there. There's this kind of, you know, American independence thing, like marketing doesn't work on me. I can't be manipulated, even though I bought those stupid yoga pants that are just like everybody else is wearing. So I think the extent to which people can be convinced that marketing works on them is going to be really important.
Yeah.
I also think what he said about market metrics, the idea that the manipulation is distorting the actual market, that sort of capitalist argument that you can't even get it, like, which I want to listen to like 3 more times. Like, you don't know what the real market is because you're only seeing the result of the manipulated market.
Right. Right.
Is so fascinating. I mean, that could just be a chicken and egg question for basically all of capitalism, but I just thought that was such a really, I would love to dig into that a little bit more. That was super interesting.
Yeah. Lots of stuff in there from Yochai Benkler.
Next up, we talk with someone who actually knows how businesses get your data. May have helped like a tiny bit.
A little bit.
With that after this. So many of you emailed and tweeted us about Facebook and data privacy and using data and marketing messages to influence the world. It turns out, no surprise, because you're all geniuses, that you know a lot about these issues already.
Derek Cohn, that's right. Derek Cohn lives in Utah, and he helps businesses get data from things like Facebook quizzes and then use that data to target ads. We wanted to know how that works, so we got him on the phone, and we started with how data can be used to profile a Facebook user. Here you go.
It's been pretty easy for advertisers all the way back to the beginning of using Facebook ads to create these personality profiles of people through different means, through a little code that advertisers can place on Facebook and have fire whenever people do things.
And we mean do things. When they say do things, we mean click on something that has been targeted to them.
I might put together a really viral type quiz where it might say, you know, which Kardashian are you? And then we would ask people in those quizzes really specific questions like, how many children do you have? Where do you like to shop? If people answered, you know, that they had 2 children and that they like to shop at Target, we could create an audience and say, okay, everybody who took this quiz said that they had 2 or more children and also like to shop at Target. And we could go even deeper in there because really, there were really no questions that people wouldn't answer in these quizzes. If somebody wants to know what Kardashian they are, they're going to answer all the questions. And then I can use that audience for whatever I want in the future.
Okay, stop the tape right here because holy cow. First of all, and yes, this is me with, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. But if you want to know what Kardashian you are, you almost deserve whatever happens to your data.
No.
Come on.
He's saying in this case, what Kardashian are you? But it could be, you know, what dream job could you have that you wish you had?
And some quiz on Facebook
when you wish you didn't
tell
have to
me. No.
And you would click it. You would click it. See, now you're doing the thing that says I would never do that.
I get that Yochai Benkler says, you know, you can't know how you're being manipulated and you are powerless to stop it because you can't get into privacy. But seriously, there is a little prophylactic thing that consumers can do here, which is not fall for stupid stuff.
Well, we can
also
tell
get
them
off my lawn.
We can tell them not to fall for stupid stuff, but some people really like the Kardashians. So we can't stop them from doing that.
I blame
and
Ryan
nor
Seacrest,
nor
by the
should
way.
We. I'm just saying, if there was a thing that was like, should you be a fighter pilot or a professional photographer?
You should be a fighter pilot.
Take this quiz. What? Kai would click it.
No, I wouldn't. He I know. Would I would click be a fighter it. Pilot.
all right, oh I need a God, slightly right. better alternative so, to professional photographer, but you see what I'm saying.
So anyway,
they
yes.
know you.
Back to Derek Cohen here. So we just came out of that with him saying, you know, people who want to be Kardashians will click on whatever questions, right? And he can use that for whatever he wants in the future. And then what happens, Molly?
Then not only does the advertiser get that data, they can then hand over that data to Facebook and then get a much bigger cross-section of users with this magical tool called lookalike audiences.
On another level, Facebook has an option for audiences called lookalike audiences. And what that does is you basically feed Facebook some information of people that you have. So let's say I had 500 people who said that they have more than two children and that they're super stressed and they shop at Target. I could feed that information to Facebook and say, here's 500 people that I want to target. Who else can I target that looks like them? And Facebook would feed back a list to me of 2 million people. At a minimum, I could get up to 10 million people in the United States. But at a minimum, they'd send me a list of 2 million people that were as closely matched to those 500 people that I originally sent to Facebook. I wouldn't know who they were, but I could target them with advertising. And that's what we were doing with these quizzes to kind of create these psychographic profiles and run ads.
Oh, no. He's not going to get clobbered in front of the Senate Governance Committee or whatever Senate committee halls him to testify. Come on.
And this is where, here's something that deserves clarifying because it comes up a lot. Facebook isn't even technically in the data broker right. game. They don't sell any data about you. They hand it over for free because it will end up as ads on their platform.
Also, we should say here that Derek points out that none of what he was describing in those three paragraphs you heard, none of that violates the Facebook terms of service. So, ha.
In fact, it's the whole point.
It is the whole point of the service. Yeah. Let us know what you think about this topic. Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can just go to our website at makemesmart.org, or you can get us on Facebook. No, I'm just kidding. You can tweet at us at Kai Rizdahl as me, at Molly Wood is Molly Wood.
I'm just saying, though, I miss those Facebook Live videos. Yeah. More from you next, but first we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
I thought that was an Elton John riff there for a minute. Gotta tell you. What can I tell you?
It's nice, though.
It is nice.
Ooh. Time now for us to stop rocking out and ask ask the question that never fails to stump you.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
I know.
It is. We sent one of our producers out on the streets of Los Angeles to ask just regular old people out on the streets what they thought they knew and later found out they were wrong about.
Wow. This is such a hard question. Well, okay. I thought I knew that I was not a gym person. And then a year ago, I joined a gym and now I go 3 times a week. So that's astonishing.
I thought people in California would be a lot much nicer than people in New York.
So true.
But I was wrong.
So wrong.
I think it's vice versa now.
I thought the act of knowing was finite. Whoa, that once you learn something, you knew it. And that was it. What I've discovered is that knowing is a process. A treadmill where you can run forever, but not really go anywhere. Part of me is discouraged about this realization. Like, why would I put so much effort into something I can't actually finish? But I'm mostly excited that as long as I remain curious, I'll always have something new to learn.
This is a new podcast called Make Me Zen. That was Justine Kleiman, Demetrius Williams, and Jeff Smith out there on the streets of Los Angeles.
There is no way Jeff Smith was out on the street just coming up with that.
All right. Maybe it was a very quiet place and he's a very thoughtful fellow.
We need to know more about Jeff Smith. That dude has a lot of thoughts.
Conceivably, you could do what Jeff Smith might have done, which is record your answer to the Make Me Smart question in a quiet room in your house. Do it on your phone. Email it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
All right. On to a few more messages that you sent us.
Oh, but there's no sting, so I'm just going to jump in. Last week, Molly said she wanted to watch Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour as a double feature. I just saw The Darkest Hour. It was awesome. One listener did just that. Molly, this piece of mail is for you, sister.
Hey.
Hey, Molly. This is Elisa in Boulder, Colorado, and I wanted to get back to you about your comment about watching Dunkirk and The Darkest Hour back to back. I first watched Dunkirk, and you get one perspective of the soldiers and of the English people learning about this. And my only regret is that I didn't see it on the big screen. Then the next night I watched The Darkest Hour, which is the exact same event from the perspective of Churchill and Parliament and the government. And it was fascinating. And I think seeing them back to back was really beneficial. And then, of course, I spent another 2 or 3 hours on Google learning everything I could about the event because I didn't know anything about it, didn't learn about it in school or anything, which is shocking. Oh, yeah. So I strongly recommend you watch them back to back and would love to hear what you think. Thanks.
Totally agree. Totally agree. I would just say do it the other way around. Watch Darkest Hour first.
Was wondering. It seemed like that was what she was sort of suggesting. Okay, so Darkest Hour and then Dunkirk. Got it.
Darkest Hour and then Dunkirk. And here's the deal. In the opening bits of Dunkirk, pay attention. Pay attention. You just got to, it's one of those movies you have to hang in with. Seriously.
Okay. Hey, so producers, I'm going to need Wednesday off. Now it's like work. It's a work assignment.
We also somehow last week, go ahead, you go.
Talked about, as we do, we occasionally meander through our show. We talked about shampoo. And as you do, Michael Zura shared on Twitter a guide to wash your hair and said, I submit this article regarding shampooing with advice not to use your nails. Because I was saying you have to be very explicit about things you tell your child and your child-aged social network. Right. Like, use your fingernails to scrub your hair and it will clean your fingernails at the same time. But apparently the New York Times is on it. Have you ever seen that Twitter feed? The Times is on it. The New York Times is on it.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, this is one of those. There is a right way to wash your hair. And apparently it involves like detangling first, putting some oil in overnight and not using your fingernails, which no.
Oh my God. All right.
Also, it doesn't say why not.
Well, so because this is what my mother always told me, right? Use the pads of your fingers, not your fingernails, because your fingernails are going to get clean anyway. Use the pads of your fingers. They're firm and yet gentle, and it will work. Also, and this is completely sideways, but you mentioned oil in your hair. And look, we've only been going 35 minutes, so whatever. When I was a kid and we were swimming in chlorinated pools all summer, my mother at one point put olive oil in our hair and made us sit there overnight and sleep with olive oil in our hair. Yeah.
Oh, I do the argon oil thing. No, it's a real thing, but
that's
I'm
like
not going to
thing. Oh my God.
Make sure that I do it before I shampoo. Oh no. You should definitely do that. But also, you don't have 11-year-old fingernails need. Maybe I should just give them one of those.
I got three boys, all of whom have been 11 years old at one point in their lives.
But do you see what we're getting at, which is all parents are this specific about how to wash your hair and even the New York Times?
Yes.
So we could be that specific with social networks.
Which is why you have to tell social networks what to do. Anywho.
Boom. Full circle. All right. Tracy Birch.
Yes, Tracy Burt. She lives in Clearwater, Florida, says teaching her three adolescent kids how to safely use social media is a challenging balancing act. Amen. There are parents who let their kids run free on social media and parents who restrict all access. She, though, believes a little perspective can go a long way.
My grandmother used to tell stories. She, during Prohibition, she was a young adult and hung out with the rum runners. So, you know, how much trouble are my kids going to get in online? I don't know.
Dang.
Wow.
It's like a mic right. drop. Yeah, I just had the data conversation with my kid, by the way.
Yeah, we're having it now with
ours. Because I realized that I hadn't, and he keeps signing up for stuff. He keeps he is so credulous. He's like, Mom, you should go to that link, click text blah, blah, blah to doodly blob, and then give him your email address.
And I'm
here's
this test. Do I want to be a fighter pilot or a photographer? And I'm going to click on it and see what happens.
Exactly. So we had that whole conversation, and I explained to him just in minor detail, like where it goes, and then who gets it, and then they sell it to someone else. And you should have seen his little face. Horrified.
Innocence of youth right there.
I should turn that into a blog post for the rest of you who are still not buying it.
Jattered. All right, we're out of here. Review us on Apple Podcasts. Will you tell a friend and subscribe and leave us a review and tell us what you think, but be kind. That's all I ask.
If you want to. See you next week.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Eve Tro, Shara Morris, and Chris Olin as well. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
And this is the part where, before I get to lovely Sitara and Deborah, I'm going to say that Jenny Josephson, our rock.
Producer Jenny.
Our creative force. Producer Jenny, and the person who has personally emailed and talked to so many of you, is leaving us to just, you know, own her own time and be independent, like which is like the dream.
Because you got it.
If you could own your own time and be independent or be a fighter pilot or a professional photographer, Jenny's probably going to do all of that. And we are so grateful to her for helping us launch this, for basically launching the show, let's be honest.
Not basically. She did. You and I just sit here and have fun, and she did the work.
She did it. She was Sisyphus. She pushed that boulder.
There you go.
And we are grateful. Also, Sitara Nieves and Deborah Clark, they're here too. Bye, Jenny. Don't go. Come back.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.